This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. Please include this license notice with any copy or derivative of this work. Recorded on Wednesday, November the 18th, 2009, this is Patricia Brown and Casper de Graaf's talk, Legible London, When is a Wayfinding System the Answer to a City's Economic Future? Welcome, Patricia and Casper.
Thank you, James. Thanks, everybody, for the invitation. My name is Patricia Brown, and I'm going to tell you a little bit of a history lesson about London to begin with, and then hand over to my colleague, Casper de Graaf from Applied Information Group. I used to run an organisation called Central London Partnership, and we started in about 97, 1998, to do things to improve the way London operated, but particularly the heart of London. Bringing together the private sector, especially the private sector, with other sectoral organisations, local authorities, the higher education, cultural sector, to get this big melting pot of the community that could actually think about the future of central London and what needed to do to make it the best it could possibly be in terms of its world city status and make it a great place to live, work and invest your time and money. And one of the things we did in the early days of the Central London Partnership is have lots of meetings with people in the development of an action plan to ask them what they thought about London. And what we heard frequently, and especially from the business community, it was that London had lost its way. Somewhere along the line, we'd taken our eye off the ball. It was a very hostile place to be. It was grimy. It was very badly managed. And it just felt the capital city that was actually putting two fingers up to people who were there rather than saying, we love you, come here, we deserve your time and your attention and your money for being here. So we, as an organisation, set about arresting that decline. And that involved doing things like persuading the local authorities that they actually needed to do their job better in terms of street management, persuading them to accept help from the local business community. So our job, in a way, was a marriage broker of desire from the business community to want to improve London and persuading the local authorities that they didn't have all the answers and really they should accept this help and this money. And one of the things we did in the very early days of CLP is lobby and develop a new urban management initiative then, one which will be familiar to, I think, a lot of people in the room now, something called Business Improvement Districts, which was a new mechanism which we were adopting from Northwest, the north of North America, where businesses invested in their locality by paying an additional rate on top of their normal business rate in order to go into a pot to manage street environment and the clean and safety of the local neighbourhood. And there is now a very active business improvement district in Brighton, and that's one of the 70-something business improvement districts that have been created since that time. But we were the first kids on the block. And this was just one tool that we were sort of devising to help think about the way London needed to do something to improve itself. But what came across as well frequently from businesses and the cultural sector in particular, and the cultural sector were really important in this because they're in the business of providing facilities where people want to go to, and they wanted their well-managed galleries and spaces to actually be sitting in an area, a neighbourhood which was equally well managed and equally well cared for. And they felt particularly that once you got outside the National Gallery or somewhere like the British Museum, you quickly got into quite a sort of a nasty environment. So we wanted to improve the walking environment. And the walking environment for us was a kind of a cipher, if you like, for improving and loving London and loving people and giving something to the people that wanted to come to be in London, giving them a better environment and a world-class experience. So along with the management issues, we set about lobbying for more improvements to the street scene of the type that you have here, you know, more emphasis on pedestrian movement, more emphasis on pedestrian space, and so on and so forth. And what was very obvious to so many people who thought about these things is that London was a very confusing place to move around. It was fine if you knew it and you knew how to wiggle around all those back streets of Oxford Circus, because most people who live in London wouldn't dream of going along Oxford Street because it was such a terrible experience. But if you were actually unfamiliar with London, you know, you were trammelling along the very busy and the rather nasty streets full of A-boards and rubbish and cycles tied to lampposts because there wasn't any cycle parking. So what we were about was actually just saying, let's cut the crap and let's just make this a world-class international public realm for fit to be the capital city of one of the world's greatest economies. And cap in hand with that was this business about it being very confusing to move around. So how did we help people move around on foot? How do we make walking a first choice rather than something that people felt that they had to do in order to get from one mode of transport to another? And this really was very important for the future of the London economy, because unless we wanted, we would continue to attract visitors, unless we had places where people would want to actually walk out of their offices and their workplaces in the middle of the day or during their lunch break and go to shops and spend. You know, the London economy was actually potentially going to suffer. So this became for us, and particularly loudly echoed by the business community, a case about the future of London's economic destiny. We were sleeping on the job in the 1990s, and we were the wake-up call that said we can't afford to just be complacent. So we set about finding a way of giving people the confidence to get lost in London, safe in the knowledge that they could be found again. We wanted them to go off and explore bits of Covent Garden or bits of Marylebone that they wouldn't necessarily have known about. And in doing so, taking foot traffic off the very heavily pedestrian routes, such as obvious routes such as Oxford Street, and giving them a chance to really discover the delights of London and get to know it better. And we wanted the city really to, and I think this is very much about the discussion tonight, to put its arms around people and welcome them and say, we thought about you, we want you to be here, and we are as a city, making the city the best it can be for you as a visitor. So we worked with the local authorities, and in our partnership there were eight, to persuade them over a period of time to look at the idea of something which seems ridiculous, something as simple as a cross-boundary wayfinding system that would point from one local authority area into the other, as opposed to what was happening in this period in the late 90s, beginning of the noughties, 8 by 10, in Camden, sitting, if you were in Camden, no, let's talk about Westminster, if you were in Westminster, bit of Covent Garden, and you wanted to go to the British Museum, an awful lot of visitors would get on the tube at Covent Garden, really overcrowded a bit of the Piccadilly line, to go onto Leicester Square, and to go up onto the Northern Line to Tottenham Court Road. So you're effectively walking then from Tottenham Court Road, doing just about four sides of the square virtually to get to the British Museum from the point you were. That journey would take half an hour on public transport, and it would take 10 minutes if you walked, but you didn't know how to walk. So the point was we needed to give people the tools in order to get out of the very crowded tube, very crowded system, and hopefully even off the sort of short hot car journeys in the centre, and move around on foot. And if you were in Westminster at that point, any finger post that existed stopped at the border, so they didn't point to the British Museum. because British Museum was in Canada, and there were hundreds of examples where that happened. So what we set about persuading the local authorities was the concept of a map-based system, and we called it a wayfinding system right from the outset because we wanted to think about things and just signs. It could be art, it could go on as it is doing already to IT. So a wayfinding system that cut right across central London, regardless of which local authority you were in, so you felt as though you were in London and you could navigate around. And believe it or not, this was incredibly difficult. And there were times when they just said no so many times. But there was one meeting after we'd been to look at the Bristol system. The local authorities and some of the business community, particularly the developers who were really interested in this. When we had a debrief about the Bristol meeting, and I heard no in so many different ways throughout a 2-hour meeting, and at the end of it, just as we were about to go, somebody from the City Corporation said, "But don't stop asking us, Pat, because we know we've got to do this." So we didn't stop asking, and we carried on lobbying, and over the period of about 4 or 5 years, we persuaded the local authorities to actually look at this in a systematic way. Enter in the meantime the mayor, who'd set up something called the Walking Action Panel, chaired by Jenny Jones, Green Party member, and they decided that one of their priorities was also going to be wayfinding. So suddenly there was another force at work, and that's where TfL, the Sleeping Dragon Transport for London, woke up, and we got some money to commission a study which went out to competition, and that study was won by Applied Information Group. And that went out and looked at things that most anoraks like me, I'm not a designer and I'm not anything, I'm a person that helps people come together to work out how to move agendas on. That's my kind of odd specialism. But nonetheless, knowing about cities and knowing how cities work, I kind of knew the issues that we had to solve, but we had to go through the journey of laying it out to help other people understand and to open their eyes. So we commissioned AIG and they went out and did a whole range of stuff, and I'm not going to talk very much about it. But one of the things it showed was that there was already lots of signs in London. And in fact, in the congestion charge zone alone, there was something like 32 different map-based systems. And the other thing they showed, which lots of us already knew, and I've just given you one example, was the fact that this was a problem. This fantastic Beck map was part of our problem, because the relationship between the overground situation and how it's portrayed as underground are entirely different. So people were often orientated or disorientated because of the very strong relationship to the tube. So they bob up in places, not realising just how close they were to somewhere else. And what we were discovering through the survey is that there were numerous places where it was quicker to walk between the next tube, than actually do an interchange. A great example of that is if you want to go to Southwark and you are in Borough, a lot of people would actually go north to London Bridge and then take the Jubilee line to Southwark Tube Station. Again, a 20, 25 minute journey, which would actually take you 10 minutes on foot. So what we mapped through this survey is the number of places where it is so much quicker simply to walk. And we set out a body of evidence, and I'm not going to go through it here now because of the bus catalyst drop, which showed the real rationale behind making this work, and we continued on lobbying. And we did we did get the local authorities to agree. We got the mayor to commit to taking a scheme forward before the Olympics in London in 2012, and that is what is happening. And that's the point I'd like to end and hand over to Casper de Graaf from the Applied Information Group, who has taken the story forward. So, hand over.
Thanks. I think what Cass has just told us about the background to Legible London is really important in a number of ways. The first thing is that the vision that Pat set out long before we were which is give people the confidence to get lost in London, has remained very much at the heart of what's actually in the streets today. There's a great deal of work that's happened to create a system that works for people, and many other factors came in. But actually, that initial vision was, in many ways, the important thing that got things going. And the other thing is that London is a very, very complex city. There are 32 different, 33 different highway authorities, and there are numerous stakeholders. And
35, Transport for London and Highways Agency.
Yes, exactly. So, and the organisational complexities and designing something which challenges the way people work and the problems that causes within organisations has led me to realise quite early on, well before this project, but in similar types of projects, that a project particularly involving the public sector and particularly involving numerous stakeholders is half politics and half design. And if you can't get the politics right, you'll never have the opportunity to do the design right. And I have to say that, you know, so it's thanks to Pat doing the politics to begin with, the opportunity arose. The balance of 50% politics, 50% design has not diminished since, as I'm sure you won't be surprised to learn. So they're very difficult projects to make happen. And I'll try and give you a little bit of the background to that and a bit of an overview and say something about how that relates to what we've done in other cities and where we think that might be heading, which hopefully will segue nicely into all the kind of things we have today. Legible cities is really about understanding cities on a human scale. Now, engineers and architects tend to be gods that look at cities from up high, and we are, as usability designers, tend to look at it the other way around, from the bottom up. So cities on a human scale. Applied Information Group, that's my company, we are information designers. The main areas of information design we're involved in are wayfinding, communications, and digital design. And we're a multidisciplinary group. So we're not only designers, we have transport planners, for example, we have researchers, we have geographers and cartographers, and those types of people on our team. And all of that, of course, goes into the design. And these are things I'm sure you, as designers, are very familiar with, that you have to work with lots of different types of people. What we do is we create information environments. And those information environments take many different forms. For example, the Science Museum basement in London, or big automated screen displays such as this one at the Warwick Arts Centre at Warwick University, or a wayfinding system in big public spaces like hospitals. This is the Birmingham Children's Hospital, which required 11,000 signs, but which we approached in a way that attempted to work for all the types of audiences that use it. Very often people make children's hospitals very attractive for 3-year-olds, but not for 15-year-olds, so we're trying to take a slightly different approach to that sort of thing. Anyway, all of these projects offer obviously very different types of challenges that are interesting in their own right. And this was a particularly interesting one where we were asked by the Home Office to rearrange the border environments for the ports and airports in the UK, all of which looked like they were either British Airport, BAA, or they were Harwich or Manchester. They were looking like a port operator instead of like the government. And what we tried to bring to that project, as we do to others, is to really think about the user, what information is useful to them, increase the efficiency of the environment, and through good design also increase the experience that people have in it. We work in cities like Vancouver and in Dublin with transport networks, and all of that type of experience really goes into the work that we do in legible cities when we come to the most complicated, the finest grain, which is the pedestrian level. And pedestrian information is not only about pedestrians, because there is not any individual who is only a pedestrian. You're a rail traveller, you're a taxi traveller, you're a car driver, do all these various different things. So one of the things that we need to look at is not just walking or just this, but how do all these different things fit together? How can you have a seamless journey? So cities on a human scale, and it's about wayfinding. I'll just throw this in, that when you get a few designers in the room, you get very heated debates. And one of the heated debates you get is it wayfinding or is it way showing, as Per Mora insists that it is. And other heated debates are whether you should have north-up mapping or heads-up mapping, and all these types of things. And particularly if it stays in that designer community, these debates only get hotter and hotter, and they never reach any kind of resolution. Personally, I think it's wayfinding, because it's actually about us supporting people finding their way. It's about the user, it's not actually about the designer. So that's the choice I'm making on that one. Similarly with the North Up Heads Up mapping, which is part of the Legible London story, we deliver the maps in a heads up way so you can see the environment that's behind the sign, the right way up. And that's caused lots and lots of debates over the years. And we were very happy when those debates went out of the sweaty committee rooms and into the streets so that we could test it with people and show that actually it worked better. So that's all part of the story. Now, who benefits from these types of systems, or map-based information systems, to improve the legibility of complex urban environments? Well, it can help ease transport congestion, as Pat was referring to at the moment. There are lots of reasons why people will go for what they know rather than what is the best thing to go for. So that's why you will hail a cab when you don't quite know where you're going, when actually it's easy to walk. And in London, of course, there is the tube story, which we'll come back to. If you encourage people to walk more, then obviously that's good for a more sustainable environment. It helps the visitor economy, increases footfall for local business. It's better for public health and fighting obesity and all the rest of it. And, of course, these things, by improving people's knowledge of local areas rather than the iconic design of the signs, helps the city identity and how people relate to their areas and how they use it. So there's lots of benefits. But the projects have to start from somewhere, and they have to be funded from somewhere. And some of the Legible City projects we've been involved with have started from different points. This one started really from the stakeholders in the local environment. It started from the boroughs and the businesses working together more than anything else. But it can come from, the funding of course came from Transport for London. Their justification is easing pressure on the transit network. It can be with a major event coming up, the Commonwealth Games, the Olympics, all that type of stuff, tends to encourage cities to spruce themselves up, and they're then kind of open to discussing this type of project. And certainly the 2012 deadline was a very, very useful. This Leisure London was never directly an Olympic project, but the fact that by 2012, if we were going to do it, it had to be useful for people, was a very significant helper, driver in the process. There may be significant urban growth plans that you need to, this is an opportunity to address the wayfinding in those areas. There could be massive major disruption which has to be addressed in some way. That can start a project like this off. For example, Crossrail, which is currently breaking up the whole of London, or at least a swathe through it, which is having major disruption, and Legible London is helping to mitigate the effects of that. And of course, there's the whole issue of encouraging tourism. I have to say, encouraging tourism is very often actually where it starts. That's where local councils want to do something. But then how do you start? Well, in the case of Legible London, we started with a study. It was a wayfinding study. How well does it work? How well doesn't it work? Because although Pat knew it didn't work very well, and a lot of the stakeholders knew it didn't work very well, it was anecdotal knowledge. You've got to base this. This has to be evidence-based. You've got to know why it doesn't work, how badly it works, what the consequences of this are. You have to demonstrate these things so that a business case can be built. You explore the options, you make recommendations. In our particular case, we were asked to look at it. Yes, we found 32 plus separate wayfinding systems in the central congestion charge alone. We found lots of different methodologies being used. Some of the signs were speaking in meters or miles, and you know, all kinds of different ways of communicating the same information. And actually we found neither meters nor miles are that useful for pedestrians. They want to know the average walking time. That gives them a much better idea as to the scale. And people who don't do average walking time usually know how they relate to average walking time. So it's still a measure that can be effective. Inclusive design and working for people with different needs is, again, something that has to be very much borne in mind with these types of systems, which are all about rich information, obviously. Now this is the slide that you saw just a moment ago. It's actually the slide about 5-minute walks. These are all 5-minute walks from the station. There are so many, as you can see, you know, stations very close together, and so much of London can actually be walked from the tube stations. You know, is a city walkable? Well, that's about not the space in the city, but the space between your ears very often. How do you actually perceive it? And that 5 minutes walks thing, which we were aware of, we then undertook a detailed study. We did a detailed study. We had people going down the escalators, on the train, up the escalators, and measuring all this time. And we found that the number of journeys from station to station, point to point, that you could make within the Circle Line area of London that was quicker to walk than to go by tube was 109. And if we can improve people's knowledge of that, then that will ease congestion as well as increasing walking, particularly at some of the key pressure points. And of course, the one everybody always mentions is Covent Garden, which has to be closed on a Saturday because it's so bad. That was the walking tube map, and there you go, Covent Garden, quicker to walk to all these different stations than actually it is to go by tube in the same way. To tackle legible London, first of all, we had to start understanding what the barriers were and how you actually recognise. What do you use? You use landmarks, things that you know. I mean, there's Eros and Piccadilly Circus, obviously the Eye, everybody knows. The river, everybody knows, but the river is also a major significant barrier. And everybody thinks the river, psychologically, is a straight line, which of course it isn't, and that creates all kinds of other issues for legibility. So those are the types of issues. Now the other thing is, it's very easy as designers, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, to come up with your own scenario about what is going to work, but you've got to start thinking about other people's scenarios, and there are so many different users of these systems, there are so many different questions that you can't even think of, that you've got to do lots of research about the types of users that there are. We did a great deal of that kind of research, and we then came up with a number of typical users without narrowing down the way that the system actually worked, and those were some of them. But essentially, we then narrowed that down to two key user categories, which are also used in transport research more generally, and they are the strider and the stroller. The one at the top is the strider, and first you take the biggest jump that you can, then the next. And so forth, and as quickly as possible you get to your end destination. And what we found was that these last two steps here are not very well served by the information. And so that's where your problem was. Now this is your stroller, and your stroller doesn't know where they're going to go. So they are wandering around, but they're opportunistic. For them, knowing where the hidden gems are, for example, of Oxford Street, everybody walks up and down Oxford Street, they don't go to St. Christopher's Place because they don't know it's there. You know, these types of things. And in Brighton, the very same thing is in fact true, that there are lots of hidden gems, and if people know more about them, then they will use them more, the visitors and so forth. So that's your strollers. Of course, a stroller who suddenly needs to go to the loo and instantly becomes a strider and has then to be able to get to somewhere instantly. So no one person is any one thing, and that is one of the key things to bear in mind in the development of these systems. So it's about seamless journeys. Yeah, you might start at home on your journey planner with your computer, and then does that information relate to the information that you see at the tube station, or is it using the same names for the same thing and all the rest of it? And in the street, on the bus shelter, actually the wayfinding system on the street, on printed maps, road signs, and so forth. So do all these different things that you turn to get the right information in the right way at the right time, do they speak the same language? Do they communicate in the same way? This is a key issue. The more we can address that, because we all know that you might use, if you're in London, you might use TfL Journey Planner to plan bus and tube. But actually, to look at for the address you're going to, you probably use Multimap or Google or something like that. So you use different types of maps. They don't actually work the same way at all. You know, it's not a huge problem, of course, we all know how to use these things, but the more they can be made to work together, the more people will use them, the more efficient they will be. Now, so what at the end of the day it's all about is what's in between the ears, what's in the mind, how do people think, what do they do. So our research really focused on mental mapping. How do you understand things, and how do you draw conclusions from that? And as I say, mental mapping is the thing. Research in Cambridge University focused on this little bit of the brain, which is the hippocampus area of the brain, and that's the one that has the place cells, and that's where you figure out, that's where you build your mental maps. And research showed, interestingly enough, that London cabbies have a larger hippocampus than anybody else, and it's probably because it's also used for really bad jokes, or opinions about the mayor, or immigrants, or things like that. Or maybe it just gets developed with practice. So, but it's something to be aware of, how does that actually work? And we, in our research, we did a number of events, including an exhibition at New London Architecture, which we organized together with the Central London Partnership, where, and the other side of the glass that we did as well, we've got lots and lots of people to draw their own mental map either of the area that they've come to for the exhibition or their home area. How did they understand it? We actually started putting a lot of these things together to build up a map of London from people's mental maps. It's absolutely hilarious because obviously people don't all understand their situation in the same way. The amount of detail within, whether they perceive things being in the right place. Usually, straight distances are truncated in people's mind and all these other kind of things happen. But you do see how people begin to understand things. And in my own experience, you learn first through landmarks, first through a few journeys that you do, and then you start putting it all together later on. So what happens is that the first stage of it is that you put two nodes together. It's you go from A to B. That creates two nodes in your hippocampus, as it were. Well, if you do three journeys from this point, you've got one, two, and three, you still really only know that, you know that, you know that, and you know that. But you also know these between them. And our job is really to create that network and then to start to shine a light between them so that you begin to understand the place much better and then you start to use it more differently. And to have an information system which enables you to do that even if you don't have it. That's to say if you're a first-time visitor. So that's kind of the thinking behind it. And this is some tests that we did with a Korean student who'd been in London for 3 years, and she knew these particular areas of London. So we mapped those out in terms of how she perceived them to be, right? So there's Westminster, there's Waterloo. That's how she thinks of it. I'm familiar with London, but it makes sense. Westminster's over there, Waterloo's over there, the river's over there. Actually, the reality is, if you transpose that on geography, is it's like this. Is it like this? No, it's not like this, it's like this. Because the Westminster Bridge, of course, is east to west, it's not north to south. And so the geography is different from the way you've got it in your mind. So if we can create that, we can shine the light between it, then she will start using the area differently. And some people that I'm very intimately acquainted with have a different type of mental map. We all have different types of mental map in terms of how we actually understand the city. And we need to understand it and work with it. Yeah? So we use some principles to underpin our design. These principles are summarized like this. There are some to do with connection, making it a seamless journey. You're remembering that the information you're giving is on a human scale, and naming the places. Naming is very, very important part of the whole process. And so in the development of Legible London, a huge amount of it was actually consultation. Consultation with the boroughs, consultation with community groups, consultation with developers, and all the rest of it. And what we tried to do was really get to the bottom of how do people know an area. And we tried to steer clear as much as we could from inventing that. London has plenty of historical maps, so we try to bring them out, reuse ones that have disappeared, and all the rest of it. But critically, then try to make sure there's then the whole process of what we nerdily refer to as modal integration, to try and make sure that the way, what we call this area, we might call it Bloomsbury, is also called Bloomsbury in the information that's given by Transport for London and by the Tourist Authority and other people, and that they've also defined that area in the same way. And you will find on most map sources that exist, that the names are roughly the same, and they're more or less in the same area. Well, that can actually cause real problems. So we try to coordinate things as much as we can in that type of information. Then it's about continuity. We use a system called, if you're familiar with wayfinding, I'm sure you're familiar with this already, it's progressive disclosure. If you're at the bottom of the M1, you do not tell people where Skipton is. You know, you've got to get past Otley before you find that out. You just see, say, the north. So you give people as much information as it's useful for them to have. The same applies in the pedestrian environment. It's actually a more complicated issue to do it in the pedestrian environment. It's not as straightforward as having destinations up the motorway, but the same principle applies. Then the issue of predictability, and this goes back really to Pat's principle of giving people the confidence to get lost. What we really create, we can create a kind of piece of information. And you can go off piste in the knowledge that you'll hit the black run again, or maybe the green one, or whatever it is. So you'll come back on it again, because there will be on the major sweep, there will be a sign, you'll be able to find it. And then, the problem with a lot of the wayfinding systems that we found is you'd follow it, and then there wouldn't be another sign at the next decision point, and you would be completely lost. So the predictability of where the signs will be placed and where the decision points are, that's another key principle that you have got to take into account in designing a thing like this. That is quite a significant issue, I think, in terms of what the future is of these systems, which maybe we can come back to in the Q&As. And then this thing of actually making it usable, making it clear to people, clarity. Inclusive design, so we try and make it work as well as possible for as many people as possible, and we try and use different media where appropriate to try and give pertinent information for specific user groups. So the map that we've assigned is rich information, there's lots of information in there. You cannot have it totally optimally readable because it would all be black on white and there's far too much information for that. So you have to strike a balance there. But the thing of addressing the visually impaired, the audio impaired, the mobility impaired, and all the rest of it, these are all things that you've got to think about in these systems, obviously. The thing about don't make me think, make it intuitive, if people have to think about what something means, they walk past it, they won't use it. And parsimony is really about the balance of information. Right? If you cram 1,000 things on a small map, it is completely useless. Right? So you've got to get, the right balance between the amount of information that can usefully be delivered that people can use. So I talked about naming, but these are the basic levels, the information hierarchy that we use in our information planning. You've got the big areas, the rest of the city. You've got the village. We're using villages, which is not actually that appropriate a word, but you know what I mean. Soho, Mayfair, St. James's, and then you've got neighborhoods like Clerkenwell or Elephant and Castle and so forth, the next level down. And there are, of course, tons of those. And we had to really get down to the nitty-gritty of what they all were, where they were, in order to start our information planning. We then went into the street with a lot of our stuff and got a great deal of feedback from people, did a great deal of testing to make sure things worked. During the development of the site, Oxford Street, for example, which was the prototype, every Saturday, we built a life-size sign in cardboard, which is a holding sign, somebody would hold it. And every Saturday, a team would go to Regent Street and they would stand there with that sign. Nobody ever noticed that there was a bloke there holding it. I mean, it's so busy, these streets, that people go up to it, and they look at the maps, and they start talking, and then we engage with it in conversation. And that process of talking to people really changed the way we designed it quite a few times. We realized that we needed certain things, that something did work, that we as designers were absolutely fabulous, but were actually crap, and all the rest of it. So that whole process was a very important part of arriving at the right solution. We then did rapid prototyping, so we come up with a solution, and the rapid prototyping we did in a virtual environment. We built a kind of a 3D fly-through type of environment, which you could really model what was happening and figure out whether that would work. And then we planned where we're going, and what actually happened here was that this is one of these irrational things that makes a project happen, because Legible London had been promoted by a Central London Partnership. Study had been done, it had been developed up to a certain point, but actually, we had begged, stolen, and borrowed. There was no big budget attached to it. So it was, certain authorities had all stumped up for bits of it. But now, so there was not actually then a properly funded plan to get anything in the ground. But what there was that there was a promise from the then mayor, Ken Livingstone, that he wanted some wayfinding signs in Oxford Street before Christmas. We were then roughly at the beginning of the year. And there was also a project called Orb, which is Oxford Street, Regent Street, Bond Street, which is the West End of London, effectively sprucing itself up and defending itself against encroachers from Westfield and things like that. And they also had funding and an intent to do something with wayfinding in the Oxford Street, Bond Street area. So what we managed to do was bring these projects together and say, well, if that's going to happen, let's turn that into a prototype for Legible London and let's test it. So that's what happened. To make it work, we needed a certain critical mass of science to make it work as a system so that we could properly test it and so that it was in a useful area. We ended up with 19 signs in these areas. And you can already see from this that there are different sign types. You've got monoliths, we call them. We call these mini-liths, because they're nice and sleek for the urban environment where there are lots of people. And also a few finger pointers. We only use finger pointers really for the last bit of the journey, because we don't think they're very efficient. But anyway, those are the main sign types used. And that was, and is, the scheme that was initially installed. We created the maps. Actually, a lot of this is about the quality of the map, which you can't see that well projected this way, but this is the map that is produced in vitreous enamel on the sides. so it's very hardware and so on. But it got a huge amount of detail in terms of steps on the street, in terms of sight lines, pavement widths, and all that other kind of stuff that you can work out. So if, for example, you are in a wheelchair, you can actually work out on that map where you can go and where you can't go. It's also, as I say, your heads up. You're actually here. Oxford Street, obviously, is actually more or less east-west, but at that particular point, it's at that angle. And so we have two maps on the one side. This is the what we call the finder map, which is effectively a five-minute journey, and then, which is a great deal of detail, including some three-dimensional buildings, which are main landmarks. And all of the yellow ones actually are landmarks or important destinations of one kind or another, for which we have to have very strict criteria. Then we have a 15-minute walk, and the 15-minute walk really is to show you, we think 15 minutes is what people consider walkable, by and large. And so actually, if you realise that from Bond Street you can walk to Regent's Park, or you can pretty much get to Euston Square, well, that will encourage a lot more people to undertake that journey than we would have done before. Particularly if you think that the journey is going to be supported by signs along the road. So then we started making the signs, and there was quite an innovative a way of building the foundation, so that we could build the foundation, and we could put covers on them, and then we could later on slot them in. So we all slotted them in. One morning we put the whole system in. And the benefit also is that when somebody drives a lorry into one, which did happen with one of them, you can just take it out and replace it a few weeks later with many more fuss. So the whole product design aspect is also quite an important aspect, how you design that. And then what happens with that product design. So then obviously we went into the ground, and this was, it was the beginning of November, it was the 6th of November, I think it was before Christmas, the 6th of November 2007. And it was still just about in time to, before the biggest Christmas rush, and they wanted it before Christmas. So we had to start very, very early, because as you can see, this is Oxford Street. Well, 5 hours later, it'd be completely teeming, you'd be pretty much unable to do it. But anyway, all of the signs went in, and I think, so this particular project then was the prototype of 19 signs that went in. And the prototype was effectively commissioned and delivered by a new West End company, which is also a form of business improvement district, but it's actually, it is a bit, and it is the organisation that represents the businesses, the traders in the West End area. And Westminster City Council, which is the highway authority in that particular area, some of the major local stakeholders, the biggest local stakeholders, in fact, was the Crown Estate, who own pretty much all of Regent Street, they're quite involved in it as well. And then you've got TfL and the GLA. The TfL and the GLA didn't really play that much of a part in the development of it, but the stakeholders did. And in that regard, this was a very good model for how a system like this should be developed and at what level it should be developed. And there are some problems now that it's rolling out to try and make sure that that type of partnership between all the people who need to be involved will also be involved as time goes on. So this is the signs actually in the street at Christmas time. And as I say, we did that. We also made sure that we replaced information in Bond Street Tube Station to make sure that it used actually the same names for the same things that we used. And also we produced the printed map. The printed map had a different layer of information on it. Because the sign, you can't change it every 5 minutes. The printed map you change every year, so it's got lots of the shops on it. And obviously online, on mobiles, you could change it every, it could virtually be real time. And the local vicinity finder in the station also. So all the things started working together. That was at least the intention. The results, extensive research had been done before and after, lots of people interviewed and all the rest of it. And PERS, which if you're a transport planner, is apparently very important. And but the main thing is 16% time-saving improvement for pedestrian journeys within the Bond Street area, the same journeys measured beforehand and afterwards. Increase from 9% to 50% knowledge of position in the local area. Anyway, 62% of people said it would encourage them to walk more. 91% stated that the system should be rolled out across the capital, which was an incredibly high percentage, because there are always people who don't really like you putting furniture into the ground. And important point there is that when we put this system in the ground, at the same time, we took out a huge amount of clutter. So for the 19 signs that went in, 49 signs came out, or 49 bits of clutter came out, many of which were signed, or had that kind of purpose. So from that prototype, we've now moved on. We're currently putting signs in the rest of the orb area, in clear zones, which is Covent Garden, Holborn, that's basically Westminster and Camden, on the south bank, and in Richmond and Twickenham. This is in order to test them out in the London area where the grain is different. That's about 300 signs. They're going in the ground now over the next couple of months. So then we will have a significant part of London which we can probably test, and how it then rolls out is still the subject of heated debate, but it's all in progress at least. And this, in fact, came out from Transport for London this morning in their smart moves, and they are drawing attention to all the same benefits with a slightly different slant because their focus is very much on transport. That is the story of where Legible London is at this stage. I'll very quickly mention to you, we've been working in Leeds. In Leeds, again, the starting point is to create a great map. Well, in Leeds, interestingly enough, the issue is really that the centre of Leeds is a retail core. There are five big shopping centres. If you enter into one, you enter into one. That was the job to get across. So that's the starting point for us there. Glasgow, it's currently rolling out the biggest of these schemes in the country. And that is happening because of the Commonwealth Games in 2014, which was the spur there. And then, of course, there is more Brighton. And I don't know whether you've seen any of the sites that are in the streets, but we've been working with Brighton and Hove City Council for some time now. They actually saw the London sites. They thought, well, we really want something like that here. We started a discussion with them. We developed the things a bit further from where they were. But the interesting thing about Brighton is that they were really keen on innovation and where things will actually go. So the signs are really one part of the story with Brighton, but there are other parts of the story as well. So these are some of the signs you may have seen that are in the street. And there's the central Brighton walking map, which you can get from the tourist office and other places. I've got some copies of it here if anybody wants one. And we then started producing lots of other things for particular purposes, and there was one produced for the Labour Party conference, which was handed out to all the Labour Party conference delegates, obviously for any particular event. Similar thing can be produced, it can be either online or it can be handed out and printed and so forth. And this is the big poster outside the Brighton Vista Information Centre. The idea is we create a living map, and it basically we manage this information all the time, and it feeds, through templating and other things, and dynamic delivery of information, all these different ways of communicating from one source. And that's quite a different way of delivering information in cities from how it's been done in the past. And in Brighton, we're already handling all this particular range of stuff, and including, I don't know if any of you have seen, if you've downloaded, but Walk Brighton, the iPhone app, is now available. And I did find my way to the tapas bar where we're all meeting from the station using it this evening, so it works up to the point. But this is very much in development, it's early stages. What I'll say about where things are going in the future, it is actually about the relationship between the things that you put in the ground and what you've got in your pocket. I think that's where it is. You know, people don't want map-based signs that look the same in every city, in every street, all over the world, yes. So you've got to find some kind of a balance. The methodology works well, lots of cities want it, you want to do the right thing there, and you want to give people pertinent information at that point. And that's it. So that's the whole story. Thank you for your attention.